Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being here. We are in Hosea chapter 9. We've got verses 1 through 17 in the chapter. We'll try and get through the first 9. We kind of got a division in here. Chapter 9, verses 1 through 9 are kind of announcing the Assyrian deportation. And we could kind of say it's over. It's final. It's like Israel's fall is going to be complete. And Hosea is kind of saying you're going into captivity. And it's not like he's saying a warning. He's not like saying, be careful, judgment could come. It's like, it's kind of the announcement. It's over. And then chapters 10 through 17, we'll talk about the fading glory of Israel. That's what he talks about. And as a, like always in these books, or in sometimes there's certain chapters you get into and you get excited about the material you're teaching. But sometimes you look at it, like I read through this chapter and I read through blah, 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 blah. And it's like, and I get my notes ready, I get everything put on the page, and I go and start looking and studying and breaking it down. And all of a sudden, it's like, it comes alive. And it's like, I was going to try to fly through all 17 verses tonight because, I look at it, there's really not much. It's just the same thing. They're in trouble. They're going to go to, God's mad. Okay, I can just fly through this. But then all of a sudden, you're in verse 4, and you've spent, I've spent an hour and a half or 2 hours just getting to verse 4, and it's like, man, this is really opening up, and you realize we're not going to get through this. So I'm always amazed at if you just slow down and look at the verse and study it, and then how it applies even to our situation here. So I will read the first first 9 verses in Hosea chapter 9. It says, "Do not rejoice." I'm reading in the NIV. Our notes are in the English Standard Version. "Do not rejoice, O Israel. Do not be jubilant like the other nations. For you have been unfaithful to your God. You love the wages of a prostitute at every threshing floor. Threshing floors and wine presses will not feed the people. The new wine will fail them. They will not remain in the Lord's land. Ephraim will return to Egypt and eat unclean food in Assyria. They will not pour out wine offerings to the Lord, nor will their sacrifices please him. Such sacrifices will be to them like the bread of mourners. All who eat them will be unclean. The food will be for themselves. It will not come into the temple of the Lord. What will you do on the day of your appointed feast, on the festival days of the Lord? Even if they escape from the destruction, Egypt will gather them, and Memphis will bury them. Their treasures of silver will be taken over by briars, and thorns will overrun their tents. The days of punishment are coming. The days of reckoning are at hand. Let Israel know this. Because your sins are so many and your hostility so great, the prophet is considered a fool, the inspired man a maniac. The prophet, along with my God, is the watchman over Ephraim. Yet snares await him on all his paths and hostility in the house of his God. They have sunk deep into corruption, as in the days of Gibeah," which is interesting. "God will remember their wickedness and punish them for their sins." So let's get started. This could take a long time, although, it seems short. The first two verses, verses 1 and 2, I'm going to put them together. I'm reading now in the notes, page 1. In the English Standard Version, "Rejoice not, O Israel." So they're being told not to rejoice. And what you're going to see right here is there's two groups here. There's the pagans, and the pagans have their festivals, they have their gods, they have their routines, they have their lifestyle. And in a sense, we're just going to say, okay, that's okay, they're pagans. What do you expect? But now Israel is over here, and Israel is supposed to have Yahweh. And Yahweh is going to have his festivals and his feasts and his very key factor here, morals. He's going to have his way of living. The pagans, their gods, they're not the true gods. They don't have moral connections. It's all confusing. This is why Abraham was chosen. He was called that he might be a blessing to all the nations, because they're confused. In Ephesians, Colossians, we call them the captives. Our battles against the rulers and authorities in heavenly places, not against the pagans. The pagans are captives to their ideologies. So Israel has a relationship with the true God. He's teaching them the true ways. They've got the sacrifices and the basic system, which is a teaching tool for them to understand. And so Israel is supposed to be over here, because ultimately they're going to shine a light over here to help these pagans after all the nations went astray, Abraham's going to be called to help them. But the problem is, I mean, this is okay. The pagans are pagans. But Israel has now, they've come over here. So they've broken this relationship. And so while the pagans are going to be having their festival days and their harvest feast, which is going to involve immorality because they're pagans. That's the way they live life. I mean, if you're in Hollywood, Hollywood's going to make corrupt movies. People want to say, oh, there's problems in Hollywood. Sure there is, but that's not the light. The light is the church. This is the church. This is Hollywood. Hollywood needs to get their act together. Okay, right. But listen, you're the church. You're called to shine a light into the world. Let's work on this, shining your light over here. Instead of standing over here being critical of the pagans, Israel, you can stand and be critical of the pagans. Nonetheless, Israel has broken this relationship, and the point here is the pagans are going to rejoice. They're going to have their feast days. But Israel, you've got nothing to rejoice about. You've broken this relationship, and there's nothing over here for you. So, rejoice not, O Israel, exult not like the peoples, the other nations. For you have played the whore. You've come over here. You've sold yourself to this. Because you thought these guys are having a better time. You thought these guys are going to bring, and again, these are fertility cults. They're to provide the wine and the grain. And we're going to see, we're going to talk about the threshing floor. And they're going to get together and celebrate these the harvest days. They're going to celebrate the fertility cults. And it's going to involve immorality on the threshing floors while they drink wine. That's not the way. Israel's got their own system. They worship Yahweh, who's the provider. He's going to teach their morals. They're going to walk in His ways. They're going to have their system and their festivals. But they've come over here and joined. They've sold themselves into this. And they're celebrating. But their celebrating over here is going to lead to destruction. And here it says, for you have played the whore, forsaking your God. You have loved the prostitute's wages on all the threshing floors. Threshing floor and wine vat shall not feed them, and the new wine shall fail them. In other words, over here, Israel, this is not going to work for you. This is going to cause you to be cut off from the harvest. You're going to end up suffering. First of all, they're going to go through the early cycles of discipline. We know that you got the four generations, if you would, and then the five cycles of judgment, one coming after each of the generations, with the fourth generation being met with the fifth cycle of judgment, which is complete destruction. In these early generations, number three and number four, they're having trouble with the harvest, they're having trouble with the economy, then they're going to lose control of the streets, and they're going to have riots and rationing, until finally they're just completely overthrown. And over here, they've been going through these cycles, coming over trying to figure out what's wrong. And the more they get over here, the more they celebrate and worship, the more immoral they become, participating in the pagan rituals, and it ends up just getting them to a place where it's going to fail. This system will fail Israel every time. And so that's what's being said. And I've got these points written down. Other nations could rejoice. Number two, when Israel participated in pagan worship, they were prostituting by forsaking the true God. And point four, the pagan fertility cults practice sexual immorality on the threshing floor. So all of this is completely immoral. Israel's over here joining in this. Now, verse 3. They shall not remain in the land of the Lord. In other words, because you've gone astray, Israel, you're going to be leaving. You're not going to be staying in Israel. You're leaving the land. Now, this is going to be the deportation by the Assyrians, ultimately. But Ephraim shall return to Egypt, and they shall eat unclean food in Assyria. Now, what is being said right here, if you turn over on the notes there, and underneath there, I've got, where it says 1b, 11.5, I've got the interlinear there also. And now you can see this right here. Not he shall return to the land of Egypt, but Assyria. It shall be his king, because they refuse to repent. So in chapter 11, verse 5, is what I was trying to squeeze out of chapter 9, verse 3. And as you saw, I couldn't do it, because it's not there. And so in here, you can see, the NIV does, here's where they make the mistake or they do it differently. Chapter 11, verse 5 in the NIV says, will they not return to Egypt, and will not Assyria rule over them? So there is some people interpreting chapter 11, verse 5 as, you know, surely they're going to go to Egypt, surely they're going to go back to Assyria, or go to Assyria. But you can see in that text, and you can't see in chapter 9, verse 3, you can't see the text how, because it's not there. But you can see there where it says, no, they're not going to go to Egypt, they're going to go to Assyria. Nonetheless, That's what's being said. Do you understand that blunder that I was, or just want me to stop talking about it and just move on? Okay. Well, thank you for coming here tonight to this week Bible study. Because I think the captivity is going to, they're not really, I don't think it's contradicting, I think it's clarifying. The idea is Assyria is going to be the place where they're going to be deported. Israel is going to have to leave their land. We're going to see this come up later in this chapter. They've got to leave this, but some of them are going to flee. They're going to flee down to Judah, and that's going to expand the borders, and we've seen the walls of Jerusalem expand. But in their attempt to flee south and get even further away, they're going to be captured by the Egyptians and brought down to Egypt. And you can see in chapter 9, verse that says Memphis in it. Verse 6. They will be carried to Assyria as tribute for the great king. Ephraim will be disgraced. Israel will be ashamed of its wooden idols. And Oh, no, I'm in the wrong chapter. Good night. Yes, 9:6. Even if they escape from destruction, Egypt will gather them and Memphis will bury them. Their treasure of silver will be taken. We'll look at that verse. So the idealists are going to be taken by Assyria, but they're going to try to flee away. And if they do, they're going to get captured by Memphis. And Memphis is a place of the tombs. It's a place where they're going to die. And we'll pick that up in just a moment. I'm on page 2 again. The second part of that verse, chapter 9, verse 3, they will not remain in the land of the Lord. Ephraim will return to Egypt and eat unclean food in Assyria. The idea there is in Assyria, and this is where this is heading, in Assyria, they're not going to have any chance to worship God. There's going to be no temple. There's going to be no clean food. Everything they do in Assyria, in fact, God has turned his back on them. And so there'll be no food. It's interesting to see Daniel maybe knew this verse, because Daniel is going to go to Babylon. He's going to try to refuse to eat the food, and he's going to be allowed to, but he's going to negotiate, say, oh, let us try it. And so the Assyrians, or the Israelites, are being taken to Assyria, and as punishment, they're going to have to eat unclean food and violate the law. But Daniel, when he's taken by the Babylonians, he negotiates his way so he doesn't have to fulfill this punishment, which he probably knew of that verse, that they wouldn't be able to eat the clean food. Page 3, chapter 9, verse 4. They shall not pour drink offerings of wine to the Lord, and their sacrifices shall not please him. And this is going here because they do not have a temple. They're going to a place where there is no temple, so they will not be able to do these things. They can't pour drink offerings to wine. Their sacrifices, if they do build an altar, if they do try to offer sacrifices, if they participate in pagan shrines, it's not going to please him. It shall be like mourner's bread to them. All who eat of it shall be defiled. So any kind of food they get over here, because in their culture, their meals, their food, their festivals, one, it was for themselves. It was for their daily needs. But also, they would eat with, it was fellowship. It was eating, participating with the Lord in the land, in the rituals, in the feast. But he is saying right here very clearly, there's going to be no temple. There's going to be no sacrifices. There's going to be no food that we're going to share. Anything you eat, and this is part of their problem, anything they eat is going to be just for survival. In other words, they were supposed to be in a land where everything they did was part of the celebration, the festivity of being in fellowship with the Lord. But he's telling them, they shall not pour out drink offerings of wine to the Lord. Their sacrifices shall not please him. It shall be like mourner's bread to them. All who eat of it shall be defiled. For their bread shall be for their hunger only, for themselves only. It shall not come to the house of the Lord. Anything you do, nothing's going to make it to the house of the Lord, because the house of the Lord is gone. It's only about yourself. They're being cut off. They're being isolated. They're going to the nations and are separated from God. Point one, they'll not be able to perform the drink offerings. They'll not have a temple. If they perform any sacrifices, such as eating food or bread, it would only defile them because there's no temple set up. Chapter 9, verse 5. What will you do on the day of the appointed festival or the day of the feast of the Lord? There's two things mentioned here. It's mentioned twice. The festivals and the feast. And they're the same thing. So this is emphatic, meaning this is just emphasis. The festival days of the Lord, the feast of the Lord. What are you going to do? They're festivals, kind of like this second point I had here. They're food for themselves, but they're also food to celebrate fellowship with the Lord. But because they're cut off from the Lord, they're going to be in a foreign land eating unclean food, no altars, no sacrifices, no pouring out your drink offerings. What are you going to do with your festivals? What are you going to do with your feasts? And the answer is nothing. You have nothing to celebrate. You're here all alone. And I write that down. It's a rhetorical question emphasizing both the appointed festivals and the feast of the Lord. The question, what will the Israelites do in these days on their festival days? The answer, nothing. They have nothing to celebrate. They have no temple to celebrate in. They have no God with whom they can celebrate with. They cannot celebrate in those days. So they're going away to a foreign land. And all these verses are saying is, it's over. All the things you tried to celebrate, now didn't. They were supposed to be worshiping Yahweh, and he had feasts set up. And they included the harvest season. They included the wine. They were times of celebration where they would rejoice in the Lord for the bounty that he'd provided. But then there was Baal worship. And Baal, they also had the feast, the celebrations of the harvest. And Yahweh, instead of staying in the rituals that God had given them to stay focused on reality, their worldview was supposed to be on God. He was revealing himself. It wasn't just ritual. We don't want to just always think about the law. They had to follow the law. The law was supposed to be something that set them free. They could learn from it. The sacrificial system was teaching them about forgiveness and about what was sin and how to be brought back into fellowship. They were supposed to have fellowship with Yahweh over here. Yes, there was regulations, but they were being trained. They're being taught. Over here with Baal, they also celebrated the grain and the wine, but there was no morality. There's no teaching in here. It was just very immoral. It was a different world view. It was contrary. People that were supposed to be worshiping Yahweh, they came over here and ate God's grain, drank his wine. They celebrated, but it became very pagan. So they've been cut off from this. There's no connection here. And so when it says this, for behold, they are going away from destruction, but Egypt shall gather them. Chapter 9, verse 6. This is the verse. Memphis shall bury them. Needles shall possess their precious things of silver. Thorns shall be their tents. And again, it mentions Egypt, and that's where they're gathering them up. For behold, they're going to go away from destruction. When Assyria comes down, got two maps going at the same time. Assyria comes down into Israel. Israel is supposed to be taken north. They're going to run. They're going to escape the destruction. It says, for behold, they're going away from destruction. That doesn't mean the destruction is going away from them. They're running from the destruction that's coming. Some are running to Judah. But as they run, they're running into Egyptian territory, and Egypt shall gather them up. So some of them are going to go to Egypt, but it's because they're being captured by the Egyptians as fleeing refugees. Then it says, Memphis shall bury them. And Memphis is, again, in Egypt. And I've got a little note down there. Where is it at? Point three. Memphis was a place of burial. And Wikipedia describes Memphis like this. There's a necropolis there located in the city in Lower Egypt. It includes the sites of Giza, some other cities there. Most of the pyramids of the Old Kingdom were built here, and many other tombs of the Egyptians. So it's basically, Memphis is a place of the dead. And Hosea is pointing that out. When Israel flees Assyria, trying to escape, they're going to be gathered. They're not going to be delivered. They're going to be collected as refugees fleeing in the wilderness, brought down to Egypt, and they're going to be buried in Memphis. They're not going to go there and live and have a good life. They're just going to go there to die. And then Israel, the land of Israel, is now brought up here. It says in the English Standard, nettles shall possess their precious things of silver, thorns shall be in their tents. So two things. There is the land of Israel, and there is their things, their possessions. And both their things, the things of silver, their possessions, are going to have weeds growing over them, if it's nettles or thorns or briars, and their tents or their land is going to be over. So this is going to become a wasteland. And we could read about that even in 2 Kings, about how it became corrupt and wild beasts took over. And even the people that moved into the land, the Assyrian king had to do something to try and figure out, you know the part I'm talking about? It became so wicked or violent there that the Assyrian king asked the priests of Israel to send some people back to appease the god of the land, because it became so violent that the people he shipped in there to live in Israel from other pagan countries were being overrun by animals and beasts. They didn't know what to do. It became so violent. And that's exactly what's going to take place here. There are things in the land that are going to be overrun with briars. So the destruction's coming from the north. Israel's going to flee. They're going to be gathered up by Memphis to be, or Egypt to die in Memphis, and their land is just going to be overgrown. So that's what's being said there. For behold, you're going away from destruction. I think I can. That's all I've written in there. Chapter 9, verse 7. The days of punishment have come. The days of recompense have come. And this is the announcement, the definite announcement. I mean, you don't see anything in here about, you know, having a chance to repent. You're not even hearing anything about the glory days that are coming. We've seen it throughout the book of Hosea. We see it in all the prophets, that judgment's here today, but wait, there's going to be a remnant. We don't hear any of that. This is the announcement that it has come. The judgment has come. That's what this verse is saying. The days of punishment have come. The days of recompense have come. Israel shall know it. So first of all, this is the destruction. In other words, this is what Hosea has been talking about. I've been telling you, it's coming. And now it's like he's been prophesying this, so you had to decide, or the people had to decide, does he know what he's talking about? Is destruction really coming? I mean, things will continue. It will be fine. It's not going to get that bad. But he says, no, he says, it has come. This is it. It's here. And then he says, an interesting line, Israel shall know it. In other words, there's a time, even with our things going on with the COVID and whatever, you know, right away people start out, is this the end of the world? Is this judgment from God? And it's kind of like, the very fact you're asking that question means there's still hope. You see? It's like, is it? Because right here he says, it's come. The day of recompense has come. And then he says, Israel shall know it. In other words, up here, when the prophet's talking and teaching and trying to explain you need to repent, it's like, That famine, that's a warning sign. You know, the drought, be careful. That last foreign invasion, that's one of the cycles. That's one of the warning signs. It's going to get bad. You've got to change. I don't know. That's probably just because of global warming, or that's probably just because of the world economics. That's probably just because, you know, things come in seasons and goes. It's going to be fine. They're not hearing the message. Well, when it's too late, when the prophet's done talking, okay, never mind. There's nothing we can do now. And then when the disaster hits, Israel will know it. It's not like, no one needs to tell you what. It's like, yep, this is it. And that's what is being said right here. The days of punishment have come. The days of recompense have come. And the prophets have been, if it's Micah, Amos, Hosea now they're here. And Israel shall know it. You don't need a prophet anymore because, look, see it? There it is. This next verse is pretty clear, I think. Some translations do it differently. I think the wrong translation of these next verses is the false prophets have misled the people. The false prophets are the madmen. We've already spent time criticizing the priests here in Hosea. People perish because of the lack of knowledge. The priests are not doing their job. This verse, you could try to make that fit. This verse is now talking about the prophet Hosea, or you could also apply it to Amos or Micah or any prophet there, and you can see it throughout Scripture. But this is when the prophet was telling them, get ready, they didn't understand it, they didn't listen. They would make fun of the prophet. They would call him a maniac. They would call him a madman. They would say, they would discredit him. Now, Israel is going to see the disaster. But Hosea goes back and almost mocking them now is going to say, well, this is your problem. I've been telling you this whole time, but you're like, well, I don't know. That's not God's nature. And it's like, now it's here. Do you think it's God's nature now? Look what he's doing. And so he says this in chapter 9, verse 7, the prophet is a fool. The man of the spirit is mad because of your great iniquity and great hatred. So they're going to call him a fool. They've been calling him a madman. And because of these things, because of your great iniquity, two things, because of your sin or iniquity, and because of your hatred, you could not, why could they not see the warning? Let's erase this. It's already come. But let's say it's the warning. when the prophet Hosea was giving them the warning, telling them all these things, they couldn't see it. Now it's happened, it's come. He says, now you're going to see it, but you've been calling me a fool and a madman when I spoke. And the reason was that because of your sin and your hatred. And this goes on like this. If we look at this, two things. I'm going to read through this list because this is kind of important right here. Number one, the two things here, the days of judgment have come. It is too late. The days of warning have been wasted because Israel considered the warning prophet to be crazy. Number two, when the days of punishment and the days of recompense come on Israel, it says Israel will not have to ask, do you think this is judgment from Yahweh or do you think this is bad? Israel will know it, there's no doubt. When they see the Assyrians burning their cities and then being taken off, it's like, no doubt, this is it. Israel will know it. Up until that point, they've got to have a heart. There's a difference between having a heart of discernment and a hard heart. The heart of discernment can see the warnings. Now, again, we've always got conspiracy theories. We've always got people pushing the envelope, over-talking things, overselling things. But when a prophet is giving a warning, the person with the responsive heart is going to be able to process and know the scriptures. They should have been over in this further column over here, learning who Yahweh was, learning about Him. So when they start seeing these things, you know, Jesus says, be alert, be awake. You're children of light. You'll be able to see these things. But if you go to sleep, you come over here into the Baal column, the pagan column, these things will overtake you like a thief. It's the same theme. And so the warning was being given. Those, if they'd had a responsive heart, could have sought. We could go to Judah at this very time and say Hezekiah has got a responsive heart. And he's working with Isaiah trying to figure out how are we going to respond. He's got a culture that doesn't want to respond. But Hezekiah or Josiah, they're seeing these things. So they've got a responsive heart. But those with a hard heart are not going to see it. And there it's because of sin, we're going to talk about these things, and hatred. They cannot see the clear signs that God has presented and the clear announcement by the prophet. They've got too much sin, which is going to include the wrong worldview, and they've got too much hatred against the things of God to hear the warning. So it's going to come on them like a thief, but when it comes, they're going to see it very clearly. So, number three on page 5, Israel has rejected Hosea, or they've considered him a fool, or overreacting, or think he's overreacting. Because one, these things right here, two, A and B, Israel's sin or iniquity was so great they could not think. Now, if I've been struggling with this tonight, and this is kind of what I want to get to here, is this. Is their sin or their iniquity? Their iniquity or their sin is so great they cannot see. They've got a wrong worldview. You're going to have reality. You're going to have truth. But if you've shut off reality, you've got a false reality. If you've shut off the truth, you've got a lie. And now you're trying to analyze the words of the prophet or the teacher. You're trying to analyze the things that are going on as God's speaking through nature. He's speaking through creation. He's speaking through the events of history. But because you're in a falsehood, you're believing a lie, you can't figure it out. And that goes right down this list right here. Israel's sin or iniquity is so great that they could not think clearly. Then I've got little numbers there. Their thinking had become so futile, meaning they cannot, they're in a place where they cannot think. No thinking. They cannot think critically. They cannot analyze. They think they're wise, but they became fools. Ah, they've got a talk show. They're going to explain this. They're on some kind of a news program. They're going to analyze this. No, there's nothing to worry about here. They're thinking they're wise, but they're fools. They're analyzing their cultural situation from the position of a fool because they're not. Listen, this is speaking right now to us. There is reality and there is truth. But we've got a gap, a barrier in our culture because a group of people, through all sorts of events, including their education, including the failure of the church to present the truth and not just present spiritual, emotional things, their own sin nature, they've rejected these and they've come over here to a falsehood and a lie. So whenever they analyze things, they're not going to think. They're going to just respond. They're going to be fools, and their explanation doesn't need... You listen to it, and you hear it all the time. They explain something. It's like, that doesn't work that way. You know, the thing I put on Facebook yesterday, the L.A. schools, they're not going to go back until the state takes certain actions. You heard this, right? And two of the things that they have to take place is, one, for us to go back to school safely, you need to defund the police and shut down all the charter schools. Then we can come back and have school. It's like, now that would be someone who's not thinking and a fool. Now, if you want to defund the police, that's a conversation. If you want to get rid of charter schools, that's a conversation. But it has nothing to do with the safety of the condition of the school, because those issues they're not even overlapping. But thinking to be wise, they would laugh at Hosea. They would mock Hosea. Whoever's trying to help them see reality and truth, they would mock them. They'd criticize them. They'd make them look like a fool. And they think they're so wise. They call darkness light and light darkness. They exchange the glory of God for images made to look like mortal beings. Instead of going back over here, this would be the glory of God. Truth. Reality. Discovering what He's got in creation that can present the truth. A thousand things come up right here of us rejecting science. What is the latest thing on something about science? Oh, I talked about it last night. The pedophiles. You saw that. That's a classic case. I mean, and again, I don't want to repeat myself, but the video clip from one of the TED Talks had two ladies talking and talking about science. Biologically, if someone has a tendency towards being a pedophile, that's natural. That's just natural. There's nothing you can do. It's like you've got to learn to get used to that, because that you can't change biology. You can't change science. It's like, see, over here is reality, male and female. But you start bringing that over to a falsehood and a lie, and now they're taking this falsehood and a lie, and they're explaining all these things in their wisdom, and now they were justifying pedophiles. It's like that's how nature made them. And for you to argue, you are a fool, they're saying, because you are criticizing reality. Whoa! Now, what just all of a sudden, we're the fools for saying pedophiles need to control themselves. Whoa. How judgmental are you? You're not in tune with reality. And it's like, it's laughable right now, but homosexuality was laughable in the 70s. Do you understand what I'm saying? Transgender wasn't even, sex change wasn't even on the radar. I mean, do you understand how much further we're going to be able to fall? These people have come to the place where Hosea is not even saying, be careful. He's going to tell them, I'm going to show you a verse, and come over. You can't go any further. You've hit bottom. It's like the days of Gibeah. It's like, and I'll show you that for those verses. They've rejected reality. They've rejected truth. They've rejected the glory of God and turned to things like mortal man, things that man designs to match their reality, their false reality. Going on, it says they exchange the truth of God for lie. They have a false worldview. They've embraced false ideologies, false philosophies, and they have separated themselves from reality. And you can see the verses all written down right there in Romans. We could go to Romans and read it straight out of Romans. In fact, you recognize those verses in Romans. What's interesting about this is this verse is not unique in the Scriptures. It's backed up with Isaiah, Jeremiah, Romans. This next one. Israel has given themselves over to hatred. There was two things. There was sin and there was hatred. They are sinning their iniquities because they've taken these things, reality and truth, and turned them into falsehood, into a lie, into something mortal man designs that he's approved. And it's going to, they can't understand the prophet because of their sin. But also, because of their position, they have hatred. And that hatred... I'm reading the text here again. It just says simply, I'm looking. Oh, yeah, right here. The prophet is a fool. The man of the spirit is mad. Why is the prophet a fool? And why is the man of the spirit mad? because of their iniquity. The reason you think Hosea is crazy, a madman, a maniac, is because you're here. And the reason you think he's a maniac and you're rejecting him, because of your hatred. Now, what does this hatred refer to? This now is something, is you're responding. It's a reaction towards the truth. And as we have right here, Israel has given themselves over to hatred. Passion, this hatred is going to become passion and not logic. In other words, this is the scary part about this, and you see this, you've experienced this. We need to have a dialogue. We need to have a dialogue. If we can just sit down, have a round table discussion. You understand? Along with this sin, not only have they redefined these things, and so they can't understand the person who's critical of their position, they, besides their iniquity, they're filled with hatred, which means there's no logic. They're going to just respond with passion. No logic. Now, there are, like, theologically, sometimes it's fun to get into a theological discussion. A classic case for a theological discussion for me right now would be when the rapture takes place. Because I've got, I've thought and I've taught that. But I think I've got a solid case, but I'd really like to have a debate and hear someone attack my position and give me a chance to defend it and see if I could. It's like a basketball game. I've been working on my left-handed layup. Let's just play a little bit, see if I can score, see how I'm going. I want to see if it makes sense. That would be logic. That would be competition. That would be trying to find, we're searching for the truth. There's no logic. It's just passion. They're filled with hatred. You cannot have reason. You cannot debate. You cannot preach, teach, change hatred. And the next thing it says, I write down point two. This fits in with Jude chapter 1, verse 10 and 2 Peter chapter 2. Animal instincts are their mode of operation, not reason. And throughout the scriptures, especially in Peter and Jude, they are like brute beasts. The only thing you can do with them is capture and destroy them. They're a brute beast tearing apart reality, truth, the glory of God. What can you do with them? We need to sit down and have a conversation. Peter, Jude, Proverbs. No, they need to be captured and destroyed. They're gone. I'm not saying that's Hosea's position or his responsibility. He's not going to go kill these people or destroy them. That's not the church's responsibility. Our responsibility is scary because our responsibility is to present reality, the truth, the glory to the world so they can respond. But the world can get to a place where they're so deep in sin, they're so filled with hatred, they're not going to respond. The only thing they get to do is respond like a brute beast and reach out and destroy the Christian. And that's a tough place to be because our mission is to proclaim, not to attack. Point four. There is no recovery option available at this point. It is at this point in 30 AD that Jesus wept over Jerusalem. Now, I've got some verses written down. This right here, this brute beast, Peter and Jude both talk about that in the early church in the first century. These church leaders are like brute beasts. You can't speak with them. And they were in the early church. They'd gone astray. Jerusalem is going to get here in 586. 70 AD, but Jesus speaking in 30 AD about what's going to take place in 70 AD, he says these. It's the same thing, because this is where the people were in Luke chapter 19, verse 41 through 44. And when he, Jesus, drew near and saw the city, he wept over it. And the reason he's weeping over it is they're in the same stage. They've got 40 years, but they're going through the same cycle, and he weeps over it. He knows what's going to happen. He's taught them, he's explained them, he's demonstrated. But they're so full of sin, they're so full of hatred, there's only one thing left to do, capture and destroy. He wept over it saying, "Would that you, even you, had known on this day the things that make for peace. But now they are hidden from your eyes." You see, they're hidden. You can't find them. "For the days will come upon you." He said, that's the judgment. They're hidden. If they weren't hidden, I could show them to you. but you've hardened your heart and now you can't. You're going to respond to the truth with more sin and hatred. You're thinking you're wise. You're a fool. You're not going to have any dialogue. You're filled with hatred. The only thing you're going to do is destroy the truth. For the days will come now upon you when your enemies will set up a barricade around you and surround you and hem you in on every side and tear you down to the ground. That's exactly what is going to happen to the through the Assyrians on Israel. You and your children within you. And that's sad. You and your children within you. And they will not leave one stone upon another in you because you did not know the time of your visitation. Matthew 23. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent. You see this? The prophets and those who are sent. Jerusalem, you're so full of sin, you don't think, you're fools, you're full of hatred, you're running on passions, not logic, we can't have a dialogue, you're brute beast. He sends you a prophet, he sends those with truth. It says here, that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to it. How often would I have gathered your children together? Again, trying to be compassionate. His idea was to be compassionate. Gather you together, teach you like children, and show you the way. As a hen gathers the brood under her wings, and you were not willing. See, your house is left to you desolate. For I tell you, you will not see me again until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. And so, consider the prophet in this verse to be a reference to, that's what I was just saying. Some consider this to be the prophet, to be a false prophet and not the true prophet. And I got two verses that support that, the idea that the prophet was a maniac, and that's with Jehu and with Jeremiah. Chapter 9, verse 8, it says, now Hosea says, the prophet is the watchman of Ephraim with God, yet a fowler snare is on his ways and hatred in the house of his God. Are you ready for this now? We talked about sin and hatred. They're calling darkness light, light darkness. Their hatred, they can only respond like a brute beast. And now we're going to go back to the prophet's interaction with the people. This has been Hosea's ministry with these people. You're going to have the prophet, and whenever the prophet, Hosea, and he could be Micah or Amos, whenever the prophet would speak, the prophet is the watchman. He's the watchman. Meaning he's the guard. He's the protector. He's the one here looking. He's there watching for the enemy. The watchman is not the enemy. He is trying to protect you from the enemy. But in your flipped up, upside down thinking, Israel, who is in sin, rebellion, they've got this hatred. They do not know light from darkness, so they don't know the prophet from the enemy. We're here. We are here in our culture. You don't know the prophet who is the watchman who came to help to protect you from the enemy. So Israel, because they've lost reality, it's flipped upside down, and they're filled with hatred, they're going to hate on the prophet instead of listening to the prophet. The prophet is trying to help, and I've got these things written down. Read it again, chapter 9, verse 8. The prophet is the watchman of Ephraim with my God, meaning God is with him. God is doing the same thing. Him and God are trying to help Israel. Yet a fowler snare is on all his ways. So what is this? A snare? Like you're trying to catch a bird. A fowler snare is on all his ways and hatred in the house of his God. So as the prophet, the watchman, along with his God, is watching and warning, not trying, I wrote these things down, bottom of page 6. The prophet was sent by God to be a watchman. The prophet is not a judge to bring condemnation. He did not come to bring judgment and condemnation. If he's exposing sin, it's like a doctor trying to help you. I'm trying to bring healing, health. Here's your problem. I'm shining light into darkness. It's not judgment. No, judgment is coming. I'm here to, if you don't heal a disease, death is coming. The doctor doesn't bring death. He brings the surgical knife to get rid of the disease. But if he doesn't, death is going to come. So the prophet is trying to avoid death. You may not like what he's showing you. He may not like what he's telling you. But he's not the prophet of death. He's the prophet of life. He's here to help you. Jesus made this example. The prophet is not there to bring condemnation. He's not sent to embarrass. He's not attempting to insult. He is not the enemy. The prophet is sent to protect, to guard, to defend, to warn of the coming enemy. Yet the people of Israel respond to the prophet by this. Number A, or letter A, setting a fowler snare in all of his ways. He says a snare in his all of his ways. Israel has identified the prophet. And so everything he does, everywhere he goes, whatever he says, ha, we trapped you. Whatever he does, ha, you'll fall in that trap. They are out to destroy the prophet with traps. Does that sound familiar? I mean, look at our political world. We got leaders that are trying to help. And, did you really say? And then they twist it and they bait it. It's like, that Hosea, you think about Donald Trump. And watch the people go after Trump. If it's the media, if it's Hollywood, if it's on social media. Welcome to Hosea's life. That is Hosea's life. He's been here talking to people and on whatever social media they had, on whatever situation. And he had room for attack. His wife's Gomer. His children are named after what God is doing to these people. And it's like, I'm here to help. Aha! We caught you. Everything he does is a snare. A setting a fowler snare in all the prophet's ways. The people are constantly trying to trap the prophet in his words, or accuse the prophet in his ways, or prove the prophet's words are wrong. I thought you said such and so, and it didn't happen. Ha! You're a false prophet. Have you ever seen that? I mean, think of Jeremiah's ministry. Isaiah's, Jesus' ministry. The people, the way they respond to a Hosea is the same way they responded to Isaiah or to Jesus or to Paul. They're setting a snare. They don't want help. They want to prove you're wrong. If we can prove you're not a prophet, we can keep going. Because if you're right, then we would be wrong. So we've got to snare you to protect ourselves so we can die. I mean, that's exactly what our culture is doing. We've got people trying to help. They're trying to set a snare to destroy this so they can go on their happy way to destruction. I mean, that's a sickness. That's a twisted worldview. And it doesn't happen overnight. It happens progressively as you shut off all the lights. God works you through these cycles trying to help you. And the more you're darker you get, the more wise you become thinking, or foolish you become thinking you're wise. Or trying to find some false motivation. And then here's the kicker right here. And hatred in the house of God. What does that mean? That means they're setting snares for everything he says, but he's a prophet, or the watchman along with God, along with Yahweh. He's a watchman. So when God's watchman goes to God's house, guess what he gets? Hatred. The hatred is in the house of God. You'd think Yahweh's prophet could go to Yahweh's house and people would say, we're glad you're here. But Yahweh's prophet goes to Yahweh's house and what he gets is hatred. They're setting snares. When he goes to the people, the place he should be safe, look how lonely Hosea would be. Hatred from the house of God. The prophet of Yahweh is hated in the house of Yahweh. The house of God would be Israel here, or you could say the temple. Response to God's acts of grace and direction are hatred. Consider how Israel responded to Moses in the wilderness. Moses leads Israel out of captivity in the wilderness, and as soon as they got there, they turned on Moses. You can read it. It's like Jesus comes to Jerusalem, does a variety of great things, says a lot of great things, lines up with Scripture, and the religious crowd hates him. Now here goes chapter 9, verse 9. They have deeply corrupted themselves. Meaning this is deep. This is the end of Romans chapter 1, depth. How deep? As in the days of Gibeah. He will remember their iniquity. He will punish their sins. Here's what that is saying right here. How is this? This sin, this is the depth. This has reached the bottom of the sinful nature. It is as in the days of Gibeah, and I'm going to show you that in Judges. It can't get any more stupid than that. And so what happens? He'll remember their iniquity, and he will punish their sin. So I want you to go to Judges chapter 19, Judges 19 and 20. And here is, I mean, first of all, the book of, again, first of all, the book of Judges, that's scary with 4 minutes to go in class. The book of Judges is not, there's no heroes in the book of Judges. There are people, men and women that God uses, but there's no heroes. Because everyone in the book of Judges is a failure. They're flawed. Their logic is corrupt. You've got, for example, chapter 17. You've got a guy named Micah in the hill country of Ephraim. And he makes a whole shrine of idols right there. And a young Levite comes by and they recognize him. And the Levite becomes a priest for Micah's idols. So this is chapters, we're not even there. This is how corrupt it is. You've got Micah. He's got some money, some silver. He turns them into a bunch of idols in Israel. A young Levite comes by, and he's supposed to be in the priesthood teaching the law of God. He needs a job. He's looking for employment. So Micah says, I'll hire you. You can serve, be my priest in my little sanctuary here. This has, I mean, see that? This is like a few generations after Joshua. The Danites come by, they steal the thing, they go up, they leave the land where they're supposed to be, and they go up and they destroy a city. That's chapter 18. That's how wicked it is. Now chapter 19. In those days, Israel had no king. And this is kind of the idea here. They're supposed to kind of be self-governed with God helping them and stuff, and their sin nature just running rampant. And so the ideal here is they need a king, a government to bring them under some kind of control. Now, a Levite who lived in a remote area of the hill country, he took his concubine. So you got a Levite with a concubine, not his wife, a concubine. From Bethlehem to Judah, but she was unfaithful to him. She left and went back. He goes and gets her. The whole story continues. She ends up getting raped. And in the next day, she goes, she's dead on the doorstep. And she gets raped by the men of Benjamin. And so he just gets up, his dead kind, puts her on a horse or donkey, and you see, read all this. And then he takes her and cuts her into pieces and sends her all the tribes of Israel and says, should a thing like this have happened in Israel? So you've got a Levite with a concubine who's not his wife. She gets raped by the men of Benjamin, repeatedly all night until she's dead, just laying on the doorstep. He gets up, picks her up, and puts her on a donkey. Her carcass. You see, where's the hero? I mean, the point of this is, that's how crazy it is. And when he gets back, he cuts her up into 12 pieces, sends her to all the tribes, and says, is this what you expect? Is this what our country's come to? So then all the tribes get together, and then they begin to destroy and kill all the men of Benjamin. That's the next chapter. All the men of Benjamin, we'll just eliminate the tribe of Benjamin. That's chapter 20, the Israelites fight against Benjamin. And they end up killing them all, and they realize, well, we've made a mistake because we've killed almost all of them, and there's none of them left. And so we've got, on that day, 25,000 men of Benjamin's swords and fell, but 600 men turned and fled to a desert rock. So they think 600 men escape out of Benjamin. 600 men escape. That's all that's left of the tribe of Benjamin. Ah, God's plan is working beautifully. The 11 tribes just about eliminated one of the other tribes. And now they got a great idea, chapter 21. These men, they say, we've killed everybody in the tribe of Benjamin except 600 men. That's not God's plan. We need the tribe of Benjamin. What are we going to do? They need wives. Well, we all took a vow and says none of our daughters will ever marry these guys from Benjamin. They're wicked. They're rapists. They're gang rapists. That means it's a tribe of gangsters. They say, well, what are you going to do? They go, there was part of our group that didn't show up to fight them, and they didn't take care of the vow. They're in Jabesh-Gilead. That's chapter 21. So they didn't take the vow. No, because we want to keep our vow. We want to be men of integrity. That's right. That's right. So those guys didn't take a vow, so they won't get in trouble, so they could give their daughters to these 600 men. So there's like a prom happening that night, or that spring. There's a prom. The girls, it's a May Day party. They come out and they dance, and it's like a springtime festival. He says, what you're going to do, you 600 men. Now, we killed all of your brothers, but you 600 guys, we got a plan. We don't want to lose you. We're going to take you up here. You're going to hide in the bushes. This is a great idea. And then when the girls come out, all these teenage girls come out and start dancing. You all just grab one. And then this should be your wife.
And that's, yeah,
it solved the problem. Or it actually, the dance took place there talk about Shiloh takes place there. And so they solved that problem there. And the girls go out and they take these wives. And the book of Judges ends, in those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as he saw fit. And so this is not just bad and wicked. I mean, it's stupid. It's ridiculous. That logic is gone. There's nothing here. And that's what Hosea is saying. Israel at this time in 738, in this time period right in here, it says in the days of Gibeah. It says, I will remember their iniquity. He will punish their sins. They have deeply corrupted themselves. Because this is exactly, what was life like? That kind of stuff was happening in Israel. And so that's an example of how far. And that book of Judges, I wanted to teach through that again. Because there's just, you read that as a kid, or in Sunday school, you know about Samson, and you know of all these heroes, and you try to make heroes out of them, because you do, they're and God's working with them, but they're just so, so sad, so corrupt. And that is the case with Israel this time, and God's done dealing with them, and they're going to be going into captivity. We'll pick up next week with chapter 9, verse 10, and continue. Again, that's, again, awful revealing to how deep a culture can go into craziness and wickedness. And the point tonight would be just the idea of God sending a prophet or a watchman or someone to help the culture. And the culture is so full of iniquity and sin that they'll just set snares and traps for their leaders, their deliverers. And then even in the house of God hates those that God is sending to help them. So when you get culture and the church both coming against the truth, it's like the days of Gibeah. It's right here, and you can just see stuff like this happening. And it's just, I'm afraid it's going to continue until it completely falls apart. And I keep thinking about what can we do? What we can do? We've got to somehow have revival. We've got to not just revival to Jesus, but there's got to be people have to wake up and recognize the truth. But there's going to have to be people in leadership positions, especially in churches, that are willing to stand up and make the division. And I think some of the key pertinent church leaders that we would call church leaders, I mean, it's their careers. I mean, it's your careers on the line. I mean, your church size is on the line. Your tax exemption is on the line. And if they're not willing to step up and draw that line, I mean, that's where you've got your captive audience. You may have an audience of 200, 400, 5,000, 10,000 people. That's where the revival's got to start. Not in the streets, that'd be fine. But how about right in the church? Yeah, but not everybody sees it that way. Well, then get rid of them. Get this revival. Get these people on board. Let them know what's happening. That their culture is at stake. The church is going to be fine. The church is going to get persecuted and continue on into glory. But if we want to continue as a culture, the church has to stand up and shine a light. Now, if God's already pulled the plug, if we've already gone across a line where, like Hosea is saying, it's judgment's coming, well, then we just need to just be strengthening the believers, getting them ready for the fallout that's coming. And then the pastors do whatever they want to. But if we want revival, we want to turn this country back to where we can be logical, we got to fight for some basic concepts like logic and scientific facts. I mean, you miss the days of the modern age where science ruled. It's like, oh, there's the facts right there. We're in postmodern. It's not just we're in postmodern. We've got an entire generation. We don't know how many people are in the postmodern age. That there's a gap. And there's a cavern between the third and fourth generation. The third generation, we might be like, oh, well, we need to make some changes. We need to do something like this. The fourth generation is gone. I mean, they're gone. Now, they're not going to think they're gone. They're going to think they're wiser than the third generation. The third generation had their own problems. But we need a spiritual revival. I'll pray, and then we're done. Father, we thank you for your truth. We thank you for the opportunity to be here. I ask that we may hear these things and understand them and make application in our own lives. We do pray for our country. And ask that you'd lead and guide us in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.